Parshas Emor. Starts off the following. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Emor al Kohanim b'nei Aaron, v'amarta aleihem lenefesh lo yitam v'amo. Hashem said to Moshe, say to the Kohanim, the sons of Aaron, you will say to them, lenefesh lo yitam v'amo, you can't become tameh. Only for relatives that are close to you, your mother, your father, your son, your daughter, your brother, that goes up. So a kol bei love to the sister that you're closest to. Asheloi zalei ish lo yitama lo yitama ba balav lechaloli kochu korcha barosha. You got to start asking. You can't make your head bald as a kohen. You can't shave your head. You got to ask why. Upazik and amlo yidalechu. You can't shave your beard. The peos of your beard, the corners of your beard. These are amlo yisur disaratis. You can't make any lines in your skin for the dead. Kedoshim yilokeim lo yichalushim elohim ki es isha Hashem elokeim elohim ema krivim vayu kodesh. And last pasuk, isha zona v'chalol yikachu. You can't marry a prostitute woman and a profaned woman. The isha grusha mi isha lo yikachu. You can't marry a divorced woman ki kadosh elokeim because they're holy. Okay, how many of those things apply nowadays to Kohanim? How many of those laws apply?
One or two of them, I think.
Really three altogether. If we're going to go all together, really it's three. Number one, a Kohen is not allowed to go to a basic mikvah, can't go to a cemetery. Number two, can't marry a divorced woman. Number three, can't marry a zona. Not allowed to marry a zona. What's the connection between those two? And really marrying a grusha and a zona and not being able to go into a basic mikvah? What's the connection between those two? How do they both put together? So here we go. Shemi Shmuel says, Kohen's supposed to work in the basement. Is there any Kohen here? Nobody yet. You're a Kohen? Oh, so wow, all right. So a Kohen works in the basement of Mikdash. What's his job? He has to bring korbanos. A korban is one of the strangest things that a person could ever give. Like, God needs our cow. Like, God needs the blood to be sprinkled on top of his bath. The Kuzari explains, we said it a little bit out in Parshas Vayikra, that the Pshapiana korban is supposed to somehow connect our physical world, our world full of Gashmias, to the world of Ruchnias and Shemayim. If you want to do the Matrix thing, then you can always say that this world is represented by a world up above, and everything that you do down here has something going on up there. I never saw the Matrix. I don't plan on seeing the Matrix, so don't know what they're talking about. But when it comes to at least these psukim, it seems, at least for the korbanos, it seems that whatever we do down here somehow has an effect in Shemayim. It does something, like when you bring this korban, it causes something to happen where HaKadosh Baruch Hu has this reach mikoach, where he has a sweet-smelling fragrance that comes up in front of him. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, ah, that feels good. And somehow we do something that makes him feel that way, and that's through the korbanos. We have no idea how that works, but that doesn't matter. I don't know how most things work. I don't take medicine and say, like, oh, I know how this pill works. It just works. These things just work. I do the same thing when it comes to turning on my car. I don't sit there and say, like, oh, the combustion engine. I don't know how it works. I did read the third John Malachus book, and he tried to explain to me what the combustion engine is, but you can imagine that's a little bit less than turning on your car for dummies. It's a little bit less than that. I didn't quite get that as well. So I'm not so worried. The fact that a korban, I go ahead and I bring in a korban, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is happy and does good things for us, I'm okay with that. That works for me, even though I don't understand the details behind it. What does the Kohen do? The Kohen connects the Gashmias to the Ruchnias. That's his job. His job is to bring in the Ruchnias into this world. Whether it's Aaron and Cohen going around and making peace between people and making sure that there's shalom between everyone so that the Ruchnias will be on every single person, or it's other things that Kohanim do. In other words, putting things together and making things holier. Whatever the Kohanim are doing, it all has to do with making the Gashmias mix in with Ruchnias. That's similar to making the fire on the Mizbeach so the fire goes up so that a fire from Shemayim comes down and swallows what's on the Mizbeach. That the fires meet, so to speak, the fire of Ruchnias versus the fire of Gashmias meet each other right in the middle, and they do something together, whatever it is, they cause something to happen together, some type of a reaction, and causes only good things to happen for Klal Yisrael. What happens when a person dies? What happens to the person's body? His neshama leaves him, and the body is left on its own, and it's just a dead body. Pure Gashmias on the ground, the Ruchnias is completely gone. The Kohen has no shaychus to such a thing. He only deals with Gashmias that's infused with Ruchnias. That's what his job is. Being involved with the dead, where there is no Ruchnias, being involved in a purely physical object where he can't find any spiritual fulfillment, will knock him out from his job. That destroys his whole job. And it can take him off of where he's trying to go. It can throw him off target. Because he'll start thinking to himself, oh, I really have to get involved in being Maspid the dead. had to get involved in giving them eulogies, making sure they get buried correctly. All great mitzvos. But that's not what the Kohen is there for. The Kohen is not there to give a physical body some type of pleasure. He's there to connect us, our Gashmias, to the Ruchnias and Shemayim. He's supposed to be our emissary to do that. And by getting involved with the dead body is something that it's too involved in the tomb of the world. He can't do that. I am there. Invariably, somebody's going to bring this up. There's Ish and there's Isha. There's a Yud and there's a Hey. And if you take out the Yud and take out the Hey, then you're left with Eish. Because a marriage without God in it is just going to be on fire. And not on fire in the good way, like NBA Jam way. It's going to be on fire in the bad way. You like that reference? Yeah, you like that? Go to that. It's not that way. It's on fire in a bad way, that they burn each other, that they don't like each other, and that they're... If you take out the yud and the hay, then you destroy the whole family. Everything's there. Okay, so let's go a little bit further. The yud is a representation of Olam Haba. It's the smallest letter. The smallest letter, and not because Olam Haba is so small, but meaning it's the thing that we least understand in this world. Olam Haba, by far, the thing that we least understand about this world is Olam Haba. We have no idea what it is. It's not mentioned once, not once in all of Tanakh, not once any reference to Olam Haba or life after death. Not once. There's Ramazim Karis, for example, would be a remez. Southern Ramazim, where they say they get the people died and they're gathered to their families. Sounds like they're buried. But there are times where it says the word, and they died, and they were buried, and they were gathered to their families. So the Yasef al-Amav is the word. And that's supposed to be a reference to Olam Haba. There's references, but there's no real straight-out place where it says, if you do this, you're going to get Olam Haba. You're going to get some Olam Haba. Olam Haba is the thing that we least understand in this parasha. There's Rabbeinu Bechaya on this in this parasha. That's the Yud. The Hey is Olam Hazeh. Why? So they say from the letter itself, the Hey is two lines right there with a little line right there. It's very easy to fall down, very easy to fall out, and if you want to get back in, you have to climb up and get yourself through a little doorway. You got to find yourself all the way up there, but otherwise you just fall right back down. Very easy to fall out and very easy to sin and to do bad things, but you can still climb yourself back in. There's always a chance for a person to do tshuva and to bring himself back. So the Hey stands for Olam Hazeh, the Yud stands for Olam Haba. What is that? Gashmias and Ruchnias. And connecting the two, putting the Yud and the Hay together, is connecting the Gashmias and the Ruchnias together. Now, if the family's together, the husband and the wife stay together, and there's no issues between them, then the Yud and the Hay are both there. If the Yud and the Hay are both there, that means that the Ruchnias is together with the Gashmias, and everything's good with the marriage, and everything's fine. Then you don't have to worry about anything. But if they don't stay together, then what ends up happening? Yud and the Hay separate. They go away from one another. The Hay stays with the woman, because she's really into Taivas Olam Hazeh. That was just trying to throw it in there. You know how to go shopping things. While the Yud stands for men for Olam Haba, because we're only into Olam Haba dick pursuits. Come on. We don't think about anything else. We don't think about money or anything like that. We don't even care. If it was up to us, we would just sit there and learn Torah all day long. Obviously, that is not the 4 p.m. why men have the Yud. But regardless, the Yud stands for the Yud is separated from that Hay. That means the Grusha, the divorced woman, is only Gashmias. Only has that Hay. And takes away the Yud from her. So she's not connected. So if a Kohen marries such a woman, that means he's going to be separated from his job. It's going to take him away from what his job is, which is connect the Yud and Hay. Now you think to yourself, well, he has a Yud, and can get there with that Hay, right? That would work out perfectly. But it means her Hay has already been severed. Her Hay has already been severed from a Yud. So of course you can put a Yud right back to it, but it's like surgery. It's not going to be the same way that it was before. It's not going to be the exact same thing. It might be another fix, and it could be even better sometimes, but it's not the same thing, and you can't take that chance. The Hay is a severed Hay. The Hay is not a regular Hay. And because of that, it can take out the Kohen from the job that he's supposed to do, and vade vade, without a question, that applies to Azona. Azona is pure physicality. She only cares about the Gashmias. She only cares about what's going on in this world. Why? Because she's giving herself away to people. I mean, she's purely into the Hana, or the money involved, or whatever it is that she needs to get. There's no question about Mohava. She's not thinking, well, if I'm a Zona, I'm going to do it for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. She's pure Gashmias. What?
That's the only thing she knows.
I'm not saying that she doesn't have, deserve a place in Olam Haba. Not saying that she doesn't have reward waiting for her in either this world or the world to come. She definitely does. Every person has something like that. And Kol Yisrael Yishlam Chiluk Olam Haba. But that's not the person the Kohen can marry. Because if the Kohen wants to do his best job of connecting the physical world to the spiritual world, he needs a way to connect the two. And to be married to a woman who severed that connection, who didn't make that connection work, is not the best thing for him. The best thing is to start off with somebody who has not had that connection, who has not started it yet, and who needs to be brought into Olam Haba, and that's with the original woman that can... That can bring in the Yud Heh.
Yeah. Question. So why can't a Kohen... Are we talking about just Kohen, or can we talk, are talking about also Kohen?
We're talking about Kohen. Kohen Gadol does apply as well, obviously. The Kohen Gadol also can't marry an Almona.
Right, that's what I was going to ask about that.
That's a different story. That's a different story. The reason why the Kohen Gadol is because of ultimate Kedusha. You cannot have any thoughts that are Machshavos Zaros. And there are certain things that the woman may bring in from her previous marriage that she wants to institute within this marriage. But a Kohen Gadol can't have that. Kohen Gadol has to have the innocence and the purity of a marriage that nothing else was involved, that there are no other thoughts, there's no other things involved, and that's the real reason why. That's also part of the reason for Korchan Srita. I gotta tell you, I don't think that it's possible to understand the reasons behind why people used to make scratches in their arms to make tattoos and make their heads bald over people that died. I don't think we can honestly understand that. I understand it as being like you tear out your hair. You tear out your hair and you grab your hair and you tear it out because you're so upset. You know, I can hear that because everybody knows that Simpsons where Homer finds out that Marge is having a baby, and first there's Bart, which took out some of his hair, then there was Lisa, which took out more of his hair, and then there was Maggie, which he always only left with two hairs left. That, I think we all can understand, you tear out your hair when you're really upset. But the idea of making tattoos in your arm, to go in and do that, it seems a little strange. So I'm going to do it, the Pharisee Otis from Yosef Eichitz says something out about this that's understandable for our level, but it's not very deep. It's not going to be the deepest word that you can hear. We have an Urim Tumim. The Kohen used that Urim Tumim to do what? To ask Gashmius questions through a form of Ruchnius. Meaning to ask a Kaddish Baruch Hu, but you can't ask God directly. So they ask a Kaddish Baruch Hu through the Urim Tumim. So somebody that the letters light up and other things happen, they're able to ask a Kaddish Baruch Hu anything they want. They can get it through the Urim Tumim to be able to do whatever they want. Okay, you shouldn't need anything else. But sometimes you go on a pitch. Sometimes people don't get the answers they need. So I'm always one of them. When you need an answer, you can't go to the room because you don't have one today. You didn't have one in the time of Tech Mesa Mikdash. At least it didn't work. And there's no other way for us to find out. Some people just want to know. That's where the horoscopes come in. That's where the crystal ball comes in. Then we have all these people that get up there and they say, well, I know how to be able to tell. I can tell the future. I'll be able to tell you exactly how to find out what's going to happen in the future. And they go ahead and they try to do these types of things. Srita, what that is, making tattoos and lines on your arm, then what ends up happening is everything's a little bit quicker. You're able to make these tattoos on your arm, and you do pictures of the dead, or something similar that you want to remember, something that you want to keep inside your head. And when you stare at them enough, says the expression, son, you start to hallucinate. I don't know if that has anything to do with the pain involved in scratching into your skin, with the amount that you're getting when you're making the tattoo, it tells you how much pain you're in. But by staring at it enough, it becomes part of you until you watch it start moving. It starts moving into your skin, and you can see that. That way, you'll have daydreams about it, you'll be dreaming about it at night, and all your mind is always stuck to, although there's other things going on, anytime you want to go around, you just look at it and it's there. What do you think we have, every single one of us has, a picture for? Is there any time where I'm sitting there and I'm like, I don't remember what my kids look like? Oh, that's right. That's all of them? And it's not just to show other people what they are. We carry pictures on us because we want them to be embedded in our heads. We want them to be etched into our brains. That whenever I start thinking to myself about other things, I can always think of my kids. And whenever I need to, I can look at that picture, I'd be able to look at it. And that's why the Tiferes Innocent says, they always assert having pictures. They never allowed there to be pictures. Because Chazal used to say, I don't know how we got matzered eventually, Rabbi Yonasan Eichert says it's one of the worst sins that we've had in our generation, that people that have pictures on their wall of different Gedolim and different Rabbanim, I don't know what that means to be honest with you, but he said that it was one of the worst things. The idea behind a picture is to embed it into your brain, so much so that that's all you're thinking about. And you start thinking that they're moving, and they start going around. And that's what happens with the dead. Eventually, there's an ability for the dead to come back to you. and to be able to tell you things that you never knew. But only if you're so involved with them that you can't get them out of your head. You have to keep thinking and thinking and thinking and thinking about them. That srita, those lines, that tattoo that you're making in your skin for it, is the idea of keeping it in your head so much that it ends up becoming embedded in your brain to the point where you start dreaming about them and where you get messages from them. We start getting involved with them. And that's why it's also to try to keep them out of your head. And also, the blood involved must call in the shaitan. That also is involved, which you spoke about last week. That's another idea altogether. The korcha, this again, Rav Yonason and I just explained, he goes into a whole piece on this, and what hair is and everything. This is not beyond the scope of this work. This is not going to be, I have no idea what he's talking about. I have no idea what he's going into. That's something that maybe when we're 50, 60, 70 years old, we'll be able to start getting into it. But he says that korcha, the reason why they make their heads bald is that the tumah can attach to their heads, not to just the hair on the outside of the skin, but to mamash go on top of their heads and stay so close to the moach, to the brain of the person, that it enters inside the brain, so that all they're thinking about is that tumah. All they're thinking about is this person, that person, and these, and the shadim try to get a hold of you to be able to do that. That's the worst frustration that a kohen could have. If the kohen wants to connect himself to ruchnias, he might think to himself, well, here's a way to connect to ruchnias. I can connect to the future and connect to all these things by getting involved in tumah. After all, that's what Esav did. Esav was Yodea Tzayid Yisadeh. He got the Yedoa bone, they say. A certain Yedoa, as in the Yedoni, old Yedoni. He was able to take that bone, he was able to tell the future. And he went up to Yitzchak Avinu and used to tell him everything that he wanted to know about the future and all these different things. That's what he would tell Yitzchak Avinu. And Yitzchak Avinu was thinking to himself, wow, he's such a gadol. He has Ruach HaKodesh. He has Nevuah. But really, Esav was only doing it from the tumah involved. It's a Be'er Basada and Parshas told us. And that's why it says, by Yaakov Avinu, Tomim. He was an Ish Tom. As in Tomim Tiyah in Hashem Elokecha. He didn't get involved in magics. He didn't get involved in all that other stuff. He was a Tom that didn't want to get involved in all that tumah. But those who were involved in tumah was the worst tumah you can imagine. But he was able to find out all this. So the Kohen might think to himself, this is the way for me to be able to do my spiritual fulfillment. For me to be able to get involved in the ruchnias of this world. And it wasn't. It's the worst thing that the Kohen could possibly do. It takes him out exactly from what he wants to do. Getting involved in this idea of Zikaron and remembering things, very strange things later on in the parsha. Immediately we go into the Chagim. Now, Vayikra, we all know, is Toras Kohanim, as in the Korbanos. But it doesn't go into any Korbanos here. It doesn't say a single thing about the Korbanos. And it goes into, instead of Rosh Hashanah, it goes into Zichron Trua. That is remembrance of the Trua, to remember the Trua that was given over at a time. Not one mention of a shofar. Not one mention of Yom HaDin. Not one mention of what Rosh Hashanah is all about. Of being the first day in the year. And for everything. Yom HaDin. You think that we are being judged on that day. And the Torah will tell you, remember the Trua in order to do tshuva, in order to remind yourself that today is the day of judgment, and it's right before Yom Kippur. Nowhere. All it says is Zichron Trua. And what's it doing here? There's no Korbanos here. Okay. The remez is of the shofars. Of course, it's to awaken somebody. But what's a zikaron versus a zecher? Now, I don't know if anybody here knows Hebrew really, really well. If you know the difference between nuances and the different words between a zecher and a zikaron, to be honest with you, I have no idea. I can't really tell you that I know anything and when it comes to this at all. Rav Schwab, however, gives one little difference between them that will help explain the whole Rav Yonason and Eichitz and everything. He says a zecher is just something that I want to remember. It's not really a picture in my head. But it doesn't really say anything. Meaning, the fact how my kids act is not explained to me when I look at the picture of my kids. I look at the picture of my kids and I think to myself, oh yeah, that's what she does. Oh yeah, that's what my son does. And I think of great things that they do, but it's only a zecher. It's only it's a memory, it's a remembrance, but it's not something that represents anything. A zikaron is an actual, it's a monument that stands for something. It's something that represents something so much so that it can bring you back to that point, and it's a pure, what's the word? A pure, anybody got a good word for it? A deja vu feeling, a remembrance. Yeah, that's really what you have. A deja vu feeling where you feel like you're there. You feel like everything is right there in front of you. That's what it starts to become. Here we go. Rav Schwab says, the Zichron Trua means that the Trua starts hitting you to the point where you hear the sound even later on in the year. Later on in the year, you think to yourself, this, ooh, and you hear it. And when you hear somebody just calling out, somebody goes ahead and does that, they'll just do a random woo. You think of a shofar. When you hear a woo, 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 anytime you hear a thunderclap, it's to bring you back to what happened all the way then at Rosh Hashanah. That every single time you start thinking to yourself, I'll do tshuva, and that's why it says by thunder. HaKadosh Baruch Hu only created thunder in the world in order to get rid of our akmimus shebeleiv, the curviness of our, the stupid things that we do. Because the whole point of thunder is just to remind you, it's a zikaron of the shofar, it sounds like that shofar, and it's supposed to be there to be able to tell me, do tshuva. You've done enough stupid things in this world, do tshuva. I've got a really, really good story. It's a really good story. True story. I do not have the name of the Rav. Rav Usher Lave was a Baal Tokei in a certain city in Europe. It was around the 1920s. At the time, his wife was pregnant. It was on Rosh Hashanah. He was being Tokei. At the moment when he started blowing, right before Musaf, his wife gave birth. And while his wife was, you know, while he was in the midst of the 100 tekios, the wife was, meanwhile, she was starting to give birth, and the baby was there, and the baby was heard the tekios. So after the davening was over, he was informed that that's what happened. So he ran, thank God, he's the husband. So he ran to the Rav, and he said to the Rav, Rebbe, Rebbe, I had a baby boy, I had a baby boy. So Rav said, Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov. When was he born? So the Baal Tekei said to him, he was born right at the tekios. Right when the tekios were being blown, he blew right then. He's just like his father. He wants to be a Baal Tekei. The Rav said the strangest thing. Oh? He wanted to hear the shofar? And then he said the following pasuk: "V'haya b'yom ahu yitoka b'shofar gadol." On that day, they will blow on the great shofar. Ubo anazach anidachim me'eretz Ashur. That what's the end of the pasuk? Me'eretz Mitzrayim v'koa uvdim me'eretz Mitzrayim v'uvdim me'eretz Ashur v'anidachim me'eretz Mitzrayim. Thank you very much, Avi. That's how it goes. And nobody had any idea what he was talking. Sorry, it was translated into English, so I wasn't sure. But nobody understood what he was talking about. Everybody was like, "That's not a bracha." Well, what's he trying to say? The Rav was known as a big Mekobel. He died 2 years later. Meanwhile, the son grew up. He became a maskil. When he was 17, 18 years old, he came to the point where he wasn't keeping Shabbos anymore. He wasn't keeping mitzvos anymore. And then he told his father, you know what? I'm moving to America. I don't want to be here anymore. This place is garbage for me. I want to move to America. So his father told him, listen, you know, when are you leaving? So the son said, I'm leaving tomorrow. So it was right after Rosh Hashanah. And the father looked at him and said, that means you're going to be traveling on Yom Kippur. Where are you going to be for Yom Kippur? And the son said, I guess I'll be on the train. But the conductor is a non-Jew. Don't worry. I don't have to worry about anything. The father fell in a dead faint. Went into a dead faint. His wife woke him up and everything. He said, I can't, you're not my son anymore. And he got so upset, we can't have it. Thank God we don't have these feelings, you know, for our children. We can't imagine what it was like for a child to mamish go off the dark like that. He couldn't take it anymore. And he said, get out of here, I don't want to have anything to do with you. I couldn't see his son anymore. The son, meanwhile, the next day, got on the train platform to go to America. As he was going, his father ran up to catch up with him and said, here, I gave you a present. Please don't open it till you get to America. So the guy said, okay, fine, you know, I can't open it. He said, okay, fine. He sits on the train and he's like, I can't take it. I gotta open it. So he opens up the thing and he sees it's his father's shofar. The one that he blew every Rosh Hashanah, an old yellowed shofar that he used to blow every Rosh Hashanah. So he sat there and he said, what am I gonna do with this thing? So he opens up the window of the train, he's about to throw it out and he says, you know what? I'll keep it just in case. Goes to America, he becomes poor, he's poor, he does this, he does that. He ends up making a company, very, very smart kid. He opens a company called Samson and Sons. Samson and Sons. He becomes extremely successful, very, very, very rich, has children, marries a Jewish woman by chance, not because he wanted to, but marries a Jewish woman by chance, has no shaykhus to Judaism. On his 70th birthday, he gets up there, and he says to everybody, my father gave me a present, and I was born on this day, Rosh Hashanah, and he took out the shofar, and he said, today is Rosh Hashanah, I wanted to blow the shofar up for everybody. And everybody, so one of his sons said, what is that thing? He'd never seen a shofar before. And he pulled it away from his father. His father wasn't even traditional, didn't keep anything. Pulled away from his father and blew on the shofar. Blew on the shofar. And it was a huge, powerful sound. And his father started weeping like a baby. This kid, Samson, started weeping like an absolute baby. He couldn't take it. He started weeping and weeping, crying and crying. And he couldn't take it. And he said, what happened? He said, it sounded exactly like my father used to blow the shofar. Exactly like it. He did nothing with it. Nothing. Meanwhile, 10 years passed. his grandson went to Eretz Yisrael, trying to find himself. He wasn't in Eretz Yisrael, and he was in a kibbutz somewhere, in a very non-religious kibbutz, and he gets a package on the day of Rosh Hashanah. Nobody there has any shaykhus to Rosh Hashanah. They have nothing to do with Rosh Hashanah. He gets a package on that day. He opens up, it's from his father. The package is that shofar. And he takes out the shofar. He remembers 10 years earlier, he was very young back then, he was 6 or 7 years old. He remembers hearing that sound, being scared out of his mind. And he looks at it and he says, this is the shofar. And he picks it up and he says, today's Rosh Hashanah, the person who brought it to him. The guy said, yes. He said, how many blasts are you supposed to make on Rosh Hashanah? They said, 100. He sat there and he made 100 blasts on the shofar, and he ended up going to Eish HaTorah, became a frum Jew, and ended up coming himself, bringing himself back. Absolutely not shy of the story. That's the idea behind the shofar being a zikara. Of something that's, it's a reminder. It's not a zikara to anything, it's a zikara. That every time you hear that sound, there's a voice inside you saying, do tshuva. What's wrong with you? That's why people leave early during Elul. They leave chakras a little bit early. They're still scared of that shofar blast that comes at the end of davening. Because you might not be able to take it. On Rosh Hashanah I can take it. But the days leading up to Rosh Hashanah I can't always take it. They just can't deal with it. There is nothing more potent to go into after you go into something like that than straight into the Makalah. At the end of the parsha, in the middle of nowhere, we have a guy. And this guy's strangest story, unbelievable story, tells them all about the Chagim. Then it says, Vayetze ben Isha Yisraelis vu ben Ish Mitzri. The son of a Jewish woman who is the son of an Egyptian man went out besok ben Israel among ben Israel. Vayinatsu b'machaneh. Ben Israel is Isha Yisraeli, and they fought in the camp. Vayiko ben Isha Yisraelis Hashem. He cursed God's name, Vayikalo, and he cursed him. Vayaviu ozo al Moshe. They brought him to Moshe. Vashem yimo. Shlom is bas divri lemati don. His mother's name, Shlom is bas divri. Vayinichu b'mishmor. They put him in jail. Lipro shlom al pi Hashem to go find out what to do. Very strange. Moshe Rabbeinu forgot the halacha of someone who curses God's name. How do you forget such a halacha? Stone him. Pick him out to stone. Okay, we have a lot to talk about here. First of all, historical. Shlomo Bat Dibri is married to Dasan. Dasan Avira? Dasan. Her brother is a guy by the name of Avira. You might have heard of those guys before. The Mitzri came over to the house. Shlomo Bat Dibri, as Dasan was leaving, smiled at the Mitzri man. The Mitzri man took that as meaning that she was making a pass at her. So he decided he's going to come back. He came back pretending to be her husband just in case. Shlomo Bat Dibri, it's a machlokas whether it was a rape or it was through consent. Machlokas whether she did it purposely or not. Medrash Rabba says she was raped. Medrash Sechel Tov says it was Baratzo. Dasan came back and saw the Mitzri leaving. Came up to her and said, what was the Mitzri doing here? She said, that was the Mitzri. I thought it was you. He wanted to divorce her. The next day, Aviram, her brother, says, don't divorce her. Tries to convince her not to divorce her. They get into a massive fight. That's where Moshe Rabbeinu sees them, and obviously the Mitzri was trying to kill Dasan the day before. Moshe Rabbeinu kills the Mitzri. Shlomo Bat Dibri was impregnated. The child that was born was this Ben Ish Mitzri. We have no idea what his name is. There's no name mentioned in all Tanakh or the Midrashim. Nowhere is it mentioned what this guy's name is. At least what I've seen. But I don't think his name is mentioned anywhere. The Rabbeinu Bechaya and the Panach Raza says because he was born before Matan Torah, well, before Matan Torah, you go by the father, not by the mother. Which means his father was a goy. That means in order to become a Jew, what did he have to do? He had to become a ger. The Rosh says he was not at Matan Torah. And he didn't have a bris meal. He did not have a bris meal. The Meshach Chokhmah says him and his father came. The Mitzri came back as well. The Mitzri was not killed by Moshe. Anyway, that's a different story altogether. The Chacham Sofer says everyone knew this story. Everyone knew this story. Why? Because Dasan was a Baal Lashon Hara. So he went around telling everybody, my wife slept with the Mitzri. This kid, it's not mine. And the kid might have even looked it, but there was a coal. There was a coal out there. Now, I don't know if anybody knows the halacha, but when it comes to a coal really means nothing. It means just the noise that people say, like, oh, he is this sort of a child, doesn't really mean anything halachically. It doesn't do anything halachically. So soon, there was another child that was born. There was another child that was born from his real father, Dasan, and from his mother. At that time, Dasan had died. Dasan was already dead. This is out of order. Dasan was already dead through Adas Korach. And because of that, all the inheritances of Dasan, it's a big question, if Dasan's children all got buried with him, why wasn't he killed and why weren't other children of Dasan killed? It could be that he was a far-off relative, so he wasn't killed. Maybe there was another relative of Dustin that tried to inherit because all Dustin's kids were dead. I don't know exactly what it is. But regardless, they went ahead and started fighting over the Yerusha. What did they say? The other guy said, well, you're not the son of Dustin, you're the son of the Mitzri. The son of the Mitzri said, prove it. How do you know that I'm the son of an Egyptian man? Maybe I'm the son of Dustin. So there's no proof. There's a coal, but there's no proof. Except for one person. There was an Eid Echad. Who's the Eid Echad?
The wife.
Who knew? Oh, can't count as a woman.
Oh, it's Moshe, is it?
Moshe Rabbeinu. Because Moshe Rabbeinu, when he killed the Mitzri, saw what the Mitzri had done. Vayifen Kova Ko. He turned this way, and then Rashi says he saw what he had done, and he saw what would be in the future. He saw what had happened. So there wasn't only a coal, there was an Eid Echad. So when they came to court, Moshe Rabbeinu knew there was a coal, and says to Chassan Sofer, he was an Eid Echad Bedover. Because he saw that Shlomis Bat Zivri was raped by the Mitzri, and therefore this child was the son of a Mitzri. So did he deserve to inherit with the other guy? No. He deserved no money whatsoever. So they came the court, the Ben Mitzri said, prove I'm a Mitzri. He said, Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm an Eid Echad. And there's a coal. The halacha is, when there's an Eid Echad and there's a coal, you lose. Just a coal, you don't lose. Just an Eid Echad, you don't lose. But an Eid Echad and a coal, then you lose. And you can't get any money. You can't be Motzi the Mamon. You have to prove that you're Dustin's son, and then you can get the money. In order to be Motzi Mamon, you cannot have a coal and Eid Echad. So the kid, that kid went crazy. The child went absolutely crazy. He left Moshe Rabbeinu's basin, and he was just some male lumbo, says Rashi. Going out of his world, he didn't want anything to do with this world anymore, nothing to do with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He was gone. He was gone. And he started another fight. He tried to get involved in Machne Dan. And he said, Machne Dan, whether they were in the Anan, not in the Anan, he said, I want to live here. There's a question, why? Why all the other? Why you wanted to live in Shevet Dan? Whether his father was from there, but if it was Dustin, Dustin is from Shevet Reuven. Either way, he wanted to get involved in Shevet Dan. And Shevet Dan told him, get out of here. They saw that he was a Rasha. They said, get out of here. We don't want to have anything to do with you. And he said, the same thing that happened against my father, I'm going to take that name of God and curse it. And he goes out and he says out, I can't... He basically swears against God. Three things are mentioned. Rav Schwab says, and this is the line that I underlined, the third thing, there was Yatzami Awamo, he was Yatzami based in Shomosha, and Yatzami Parsha Shalamawa. He saw the Lechem Aponim, the showbread. He saw how old it was, and Rav Olson as a whole board, and how old it, the bread, the showbread, and what it is, and how long it is. He said, that bread is 9 days old. Who would feed 9-day-old bread, even to the worst beggar in the world? You wouldn't give 9-day-old bread. And you give that to the Kohanim and the Beis HaMikdash? Because when was the Lechem Aponim made? On Friday. It was put on the table, on the Shulchan, on Shabbos. It was left there for a full week. And the next Shabbos, they would take it off the table and they would feed it to the Kohanim. You feed it to the Kohanim. 9 days later, you're going to give it over to the Kohanim? Said the Ben Ish Mitzri, said the Mekowel, that's ridiculous. How could you do such a thing? It's stale, it's disgusting, it's moldy, it's old. How could you do such a thing? Here's the Kasher Rav Schwab asks. I don't understand. I thought we have a medrash that says, Kisi Luko, Kisi Duro, Kaksi Luko. And when they took it off, it was just as fresh as when they put it on. Right? It was just as fresh. It was fresh and warm and hot. So why didn't they look at him and say, what in the world is wrong with you? It's not true. You're telling over a lie. It's not 90s old. It's not moldy and stale and old and everything like that. It's warm. It's fresh. Look at it. It looks good. It doesn't look bad. Listen to this for Schwab. He says the line, only someone who believes in Hashem, that Hashem can do everything, is Zohar to see the wonders that Hashem will do for us. When Mashiach comes, there's going to be these flows that you will never ever see in your life. There's going to be miracles that you cannot imagine with the greatest imagination. Those people who say that everything can be explained through our world, naturally. You can say that the world was created in a natural way. You can say that everything runs in a natural order. And then all the things that I don't understand must not exist. They will not be Zoha to see those miracles. They'll see it as a hurricane. They're going to see it as an earthquake. They're going to see it as even an atom bomb. A person turning on an atom bomb. But those people believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can do anything, that believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has the ability to be able to take care of every single person at any time, those people will see HaKadosh Baruch Hu coming down Ba'atzmo, destroying all the Rishayim of the world. taking care of all the things that need to be destroyed in this world. If you believe in miracles, you'll see the miracles. If you don't believe in those miracles, you won't see them at all. The Mekalo was Yatza Me'olamo. He didn't believe it anymore. He left this world and he said, forget it. There's nothing in this world. God doesn't exist. Or God does exist, but he doesn't care about us. He doesn't have anything to do with this. So even though the Lechem upon him was fresh, and everybody looked at him and said, what are you talking about? It's fresh. He looked at it and said, no, it's not. It's stale. He was looking at bread a different way. He wasn't seeing it with the eyes of those people who believe in miracles. He was seeing it with eyes of people who don't believe in miracles. So he saw it as stale, moldy bread. And the people looked at him and said, what, are you joking? It's not stale and moldy. It's fresh. It's normal. It's warm. And he said, it's not. And that was the argument. He was so far gone, he couldn't see it. He couldn't see anything. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know what to do with him. He didn't know what to do with him, right? Threw him into jail. It's such a kasha. What? No, how could you not know of a Beferish Halacha? If somebody cursed God, you're Chaim Yisrael, what?
He was Jewish.
Even so, cursing God, Baruch Hashem, is one of the seven mitzvahs B'nai Noach. It's even more so we'd know what to do. How could you forget this halacha? Bishlama by the Mekoshe Shetim, the guy who's collecting wood on Shabbos, Slavkud. Okay, him I can understand why he didn't know what to do. Because Slavkud was L'shem Shamayim. And because he did things L'shem Shamayim, Moshe Rabbeinu thought, well, maybe you shouldn't die. Because if you do the sin, then maybe you should die L'shem Shamayim. But this guy didn't do the sin L'shem, but this guy did it L'shem Shamayim. So maybe you shouldn't die. Maybe you should have something else happen to him. But the Mekalel, you can't curse God L'shem Shamayim. There's no way. So Moshe Rabbeinu looked at him and said, well, what am I supposed to do? So I don't understand. What do you mean, what are you supposed to do? Of course you should know what to do. There's no question you got to kill him. There's no question. It's a straight out halacha from Moshe Rabbeinu Misina. So how come Moshe Rabbeinu forget it? Listen to this verse. Pshat is, that has to do with the Zikaron. How do people remember things? You have a picture in your head, and it just sits inside there. And when you need to recall it, you just bring it out. Anybody know those Cam Jansen books? Cam Jansen, she has a camera, she's able to... She goes click, and she thinks it's a camera. She has a little thing. So my daughter loves them now. She reads every single one of these Cam Jansen books. She's read every single one of them. They're all about this little kid. She takes pictures of and everything. You have that camera. You're taking those pictures. The problem is pulling them out. The problem is getting those pictures out. Getting those pictures out, because I have a daughter. Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry. But either way, the problem is getting those things out of your head. Moshe Rabbeinu had an issue. If you want to remember the halacha for a Korban Pesach, you can picture in your head Korban Pesach and be able to look at the whole process in your head, see how the Kohen does it, see how the Kohen's shechting it, how he's makabel the blood, how he's bringing it over to the Mizbeach and then giving it back and stripping the flesh. You can picture it in your head what's happening, and that'll help you remember it. Otherwise, just abstract, and you won't really be able to pull it out. You won't be able to really get it. A Mekalel, what do you have to picture in your head? To remember the halacha of someone who curses God, you have to picture someone cursing God. Moshe Rabbeinu had such a pure mind, he couldn't picture it. It couldn't fit inside his head. It became, instead of something that he had mamish in his head, picturing and seeing it as the rest of the Torah was in his head, this was the one thing that Imamish had no ability to understand or to be Musak. He couldn't figure a person cursing HaKadosh Baruch Hu? What's pshat? Well, what does that mean? He couldn't bring it up. So what? There was an abstract idea in his head where there was part of his head where it said, here's the halacha by Mekalel. But he couldn't pull it out because it wasn't right there. He couldn't picture it ever happening. And when it happened, he said, oy vey, what do you do for such a person? He couldn't even imagine that death was enough of a punishment for such a person. He had no idea what to do. Maybe we should torture him? He couldn't picture it. He couldn't figure it out. That's why, because Tumunas Hashem Yavid, he was always looking at Kadosh Baruch Hu. So he sat there and he said, what am I supposed to do? That's why you have to ask a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and a Kadosh Baruch Hu gave it to him. So what is pshat? Why would anybody curse Hashem? I mean, I understand you don't believe in God. You don't believe in God. If you believe in God, then you believe in him. You believe that he's there. But to curse him? What does that do? What does it do to say to somebody, I hate to say it, but that four-letter word, and then with a Y-O-U right afterward. What does it help? Right afterward. What's the shot? How does it help? But people do it all the time. People do it all the time. And it works. They say those two words, seven letters altogether, and they are sometimes the most potent, most powerful. The other person who hears it is just like, oh, you're killing me. And they mean it. And the person who says it all of a sudden feels a lot better. What in the world is going on? How is it that you have such potency with those seven letters, with two words that comes out? Listen to this chat. He says, the greatest pleasure that a person can have in this world is being davuk to Hashem, being close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, being as close as you can when you're mamish with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. A battle between two people is called what in Hebrew? Not a melchama, a battle. A krov. The word krov means to be close. Hand-to-hand combat is going up to the person. When you see wrestling and you see boxing and everything, they're getting close to one another. Sometimes they even hug each other while they're boxing or while they're wrestling. They're even hugging each other. Obviously, they have malicious intent. Malicious intent. They're trying to get a hold of each other and trying to gain on top of each other. But the whole shot is that when you're trying to fight the other guy, you're getting closer to the guy. You're getting closer to the guy. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's the exact same way. When a person is cursing out HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's his way of being davuk to Hashem through the Tzad HaTumah. He believes in God, and he wants to have a good feeling. And right now he thinks that God has wronged him. And the Satan gives you the greatest feeling in the world when you curse him out. When you start fighting him and doing that. That all of a sudden, it's the greatest feeling you will ever feel. It's the exact opposite of Dveikus in Hashem. Dveikus in Hashem is the greatest spiritual feeling that you can have. Cursing out God is the greatest physical pleasure that a person can ever have. There's no greater physical pleasure. The difference? Being davuk to Hashem lasts. Cursing out God is a fleeting moment. It's a fleeting passing hanoah. It's like going down the roller coaster and then you're done. It's like one big roller coaster where you go down, it's like the giant drop. You just go down and you're done. You're done. I know, they go down and up and down and up. I know, so you can throw up and up. But if you just go straight down, you go straight down and then you're done. There's nothing left. And you're sitting there like, that was it? That's all it is. That's all it is. There's nothing else to it. It's the rush. It's the pleasure. It's the anah that I get, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives me just to curse out God, and then done. It's gone. There's nothing left. It's a crazy, crazy feeling. And the Mikalo couldn't bring himself. It was like a krov. He's trying to get close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He said, God, what do you want from me? God, what do you want from me? And he gave in to his Yetzer Hara. And he allowed himself to get the greatest physical pleasure that a person can have in this world. A horrible pleasure. A pleasure that gives you a tremendous onesh. But the greatest physical pleasure that is pure satan, pure from the Tzad HaTumah, pure from Gashmias. And that's the idea behind why a fight is called a krov. You get close to the guy in order to try to defeat him. And that's what this guy was doing, getting close to a HaKadosh Baruch Hu in order to defeat him. I have no doubt. Well, we'll stop with this. Have a good Shabbos. We'll stop with that.